From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when CNN decided that it was time to uncover the truth about what happened between the Russian government and the Trump campaign during the 2016 election. How was CNN going to do this? Well, in part, by asking the viewers, of course. CNN posted a series of questions to listeners, viewers, on social media about whether they thought there was enough evidence to decide there was collusion between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin. Never mind that the average American cannot give an accurate legal definition of collusion, nor has the average American studied Russian politics or the Kremlin's tendencies in international affairs. People had opinions, and it was time to share them. Well, that brings us to this hour's guest, who happens to actually be an expert in Russian affairs. Here are his credentials. Tom Nichols is a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. He's an adjunct professor at the Harvard Extension School, a former aide in the U.S. Senate. He's written a lot, but he's in Rochester, a guest at the College at Brockport, to discuss his newest book. It's called The Death of Expertise, and it's a romp through the modern American tendencies to dismiss expertise, to lampoon the experts, to refuse to accept new information, or to set one's ego aside. Nichols, who is a longtime conservative, says the Republican Party and President Trump in particular offer a hard look at what can happen when experts are mocked and ignored. Nichols says it's dangerous. Tom Nichols, thanks for being here. Welcome to Connections.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I know you're traveling a lot. Are you on tour right now? Do you feel like a rock star?
Well, for about the past year or so, yeah, I've been doing a lot of travel related to the book and some of the issues, and it kind of surprised me as well. So, but yeah, it's been a lot of miles.
Well, I think this book is one of the most important books written in my lifetime, and I don't want to waste your time. I want to talk a lot about how this came together. There have always been blowhards in the world. There have always been loudmouths, know-nothings.
Might even be one in this studio right now.
Well, look, you just got here. Don't insult the host. But you didn't write this book because our modern era is like any other. Was there a moment where you kind of looked around and went, all right, that's enough?
Yes.
There was.
Yes. This actually was some years ago that I was talking with both in person and on social media about the Edward Snowden caper. And, you know, I'm a Russia expert. I speak Russian. And I should add, by the way, I don't represent the U.S. government in this conversation, of course. And my personal view was that I kept telling people, look, there's the hand of Russia behind this. I mean, this is nobody just ends up in Moscow. This thing is going to, you know, play out in a certain way. And of course, a lot of younger folks didn't want to hear that. They wanted to believe that this was a very noble, selfless kind of thing. And finally, I said, look, it's an educated guess, but I think it's a pretty good guess. And a young person said to me, Tom, I don't think you understand Russia. Let me explain Russia to you. And at that moment, and that's when I said, okay, enough. That's when I said, that's it. And I sat back and I kind of thought about it. And I said, and I actually talked with some colleagues. And I said, have you had this similar experience of people not just doubting your expertise, but explaining your own field of expertise back to you from a position of complete ignorance? And it turned out to be a very common experience. And that's what made me write about it.
Initially, a piece for The Federalist.
Actually, a piece on a blog that I used to have, and The Federalist kind of scooped it up. And I was surprised. They said, hey, we really like this piece. Can we run it? And I said, sure. I gave it to him for nothing. I said, sure, you know. And, you know, it's me, you know.
Some capitalist you are.
Yeah. Well, you know, like if you really want to, you know, 2,000 words of, you know, old man yelling at clouds and telling the damn kids to get off his lawn, sure. And we were surprised at how fast it went viral when they ran it on their site. I mean, you know, it was their biggest piece of the year, their first year out.
I think the universality of the experience of experts being doubted, being mocked, the disdain for expertise. So the book, as I mentioned, is The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. And I'm hoping it falls into the hands of students who are still forming opinions and themselves. Are you hearing from professors? Are you hearing from high school teachers who are saying, I'm going to assign this book in class?
Yes. And it's, again, surprising, but gratifying. And I know it's being assigned at the college level. I know that high school teachers are recommending it, and in part because it's not a comfortable book for students to read. I mean, it challenges them. It says that they are not. There's a lot in the book about how students are coddled too much and told that they're awesome every day. And the book says, you know, maybe that's not true and that you need to develop critical thinking skills. And so I have found that, yeah, it's turning out that students are getting it more often than I expected they would.
Yeah, you say in the book the college has become, or the higher ed has become, so transactional, and there is pressure to get good reviews from students because that leads to more students wanting to go there, and the and pressure for professors, adjunct professors, but professors of all sorts, to get those good reviews. So the concerns were not really challenging students the way we used to?
Right. I think, as I put it in the book, college has become a client servicing organization. And in part, there's a market dynamic because there's an unlimited amount of loan money out there. I think we're in the middle of an education bubble that's going to pop sooner or later. But there's all this loan money. There are fewer students than there were, you know, during the baby boom when we built all these facilities and endowed a lot of these colleges. And so to get students to grab their attention at 17 or 18 years old, they say things like, we have great rock climbing, and we have pizza, and we have cool dorms, and you'll never flunk a class because we love you so much.
And they rarely say the last thing. They sort of imply it.
You'd be surprised how close they get to actually saying it sometimes, yeah. You know, they won't say it's impossible to flunk a class, but increasingly, one of the things I heard from teachers and from colleagues is that academic administration, both in K through 12 and in colleges, say if the student fails, it's your fault that you didn't do something for them, which is pretty much saying, you know, we can't fail you. And I think that that's an unhealthy thing. I think it doesn't help students develop. Sometimes, you know, sometimes the greatest learning experience in the world is when you try really, really hard and you give it your best and you get a C. And that's when you step back and say, you know, maybe I'm not good at this and I would be better at something else.
Well, and so that is interesting that a number of professors are going to be assigning Tom's book. But obviously the book has so much more than just a section on higher ed. And, you know, I do want to talk a little bit about students, though, because we want students to be engaged. We want them to be thinking about the world and not just stuck on their devices, stuck in sort of myopic little nothings. But then there's also, I think, questions about what's appropriate, what's working, what's not. The Parkland students have been everywhere. And I want to quote one of the students who've been really particularly mixing it up with people and get your take on this. David Hogg tweeted the following. He writes on Twitter, quote, throughout history, violence and war only creates more of itself. For example, World War I, then World War II, then the Cold War, then the Korean War and Vietnam, and up to today. While nonviolent movements like Gandhi's, the suffrage movement or civil rights movement lead to peace and long-lasting change, ours will too, end quote. Now, that led to a response from Dan Dresner, a Tufts professor and Washington Post contributor, who says, I'm going to gently suggest that you stop tweeting on this and take some classes in international relations before revisiting this topic. Do you take a particular side there?
Well,
I imagine you're with Dresner.
I should say Dan Dresner is a friend, yeah, and I loved his response, and my only regret is that I didn't get it in first. You know, I actually wrote a piece in USA Today about a month ago about the Parkland kids and the whole Laura Ingraham business. And I said, you know, thrusting children into instant celebrity and treating them as oracles, whether they are, you know, because one of them is out there now hanging out with Ben Shapiro and, you know, doing stuff about the importance of the Second Amendment and gun ownership. And Hogg was at the White House correspondents' dinner. You know, this is unhealthy. And it's unhealthy not because of the political views of these kids, but because, again, it's this that tragedy is a shortcut to expertise, right? To say, I'm an expert in having been shot at in a school tragedy. Okay, but that's like saying, you know, the survivors of a plane crash should be consulted on improving the avionics of the 737. It's not a form of expertise. It's a form of instant celebrity. And what we really prize in America is instant celebrity. And I think it's, just to add, you know, kind of, I think people will find this maybe, teachers, well, I hope, will take it the right way. Parents, I think, will take it the right way. Others will think it's too paternalistic. But I don't think this is healthy for any of these kids. I really don't. I don't think that you survive a school shooting, go through this horrendous 6 minutes of hell, and then deal with it by, you know, going to rallies and being in green rooms at CNN and MSNBC and Fox and everywhere else. I just don't think it's a healthy thing.
Okay. And so this is where I'd like to push back in the way that I'm sure others have, with a little more vitriol online.
Yes.
Twitter really encourages vitriol. But let me at least ask, if you're right, they are not an expert. Most of these students, as far as I know, are not experts in gun policy, the way Washington policy gets made at all, probably not even on firearms. But would they have the emotional urgency that comes from having been through that and been through that loss? Might, I think they would argue, would empowers them to try to not take no for an answer on sort of the the intractability of Washington in the same way that a plane crash survivor might say, look, I'm not an expert on aviation safety, but if we have some sort of a system that allows planes to fly poorly watched over, then somebody has to stand up and say, damn it, you have to change it.
That's a fair point, but there's a couple of things to think about here. One is life is more complicated than just yes or no answers, particularly where people's constitutional rights are concerned. Simply saying yes or no, you know, for one thing, you're never going to have a world of zero defects where there are no school shootings and no plane crashes. That's not going to happen. And so the question is, you know, mitigating risk. And that is a very complicated and very difficult issue, especially for a country that does not understand mathematics. As you know, somebody online tried to point out during this whole flap that, you know, the number of kids being shot in schools is actually declining since the 1990s, and people simply flatly refused to believe it. They said, that can't be true, because, again, it's like plane crashes, right? So you see a spectacular plane crash, you say there must be some safety issue, even if it's increasingly rare. The other thing, though, that I, and this is more related to the themes I raise in the book, is that this shortcutting to definitiveness and expertise, right? Well, I went through a shooting or I went through a plane crash and therefore my voice is now authoritative. In the piece I wrote on this, my recommendation to the Parkland kids was, if you really want to kind of work through this grief and feel part of something, start local. Learn how your town works. You know, go to the Florida legislature. You know, figure out what the gun ordinances are like in your county in Florida. Work with the adults around you to understand the world, because there's a huge learning opportunity here. And instead, we've taken children and set them up as instant, and I wish I could claim credit for this, but a colleague of mine called them instant oracles, that they are now at 17 years old completely wise. And I will say the other point I wanted to make about this is this really does become highly partisan, because the same people that are encouraging the Parkland kids think it's despicable when anti-abortion groups have teenagers and children marching as they do every year, right? And they put children out there, 9-year-olds saying, boy, I'm glad mommy didn't abort me. I personally think that's horrible. I don't want children involved in those marches any more than I want them, you know, having a national skip day for gun rights or gun control or whatever it is. I think adults need to shoulder their responsibility. But I think the people who really support some of these moments need to think about, would you feel the same way if that 16-year-old were standing up and saying, I'm for overturning Roe v. Wade? Because there are 16-year-olds out there saying it every day. And my attitude is, I do not take policy recommendations from 16-year-olds, period. That's an adult's job.
Now, let me pivot the gun conversation a little bit here, because one of the most consistently difficult parts of the debate over gun control, gun law, is what the people who wrote the Second Amendment might say if they understood what semi-automatic weapons look like.
Right.
Obviously, they didn't at the time.
And let me just say, I'm a gun control guy. I grew up in a family of police officers. Who were not in favor of everybody walking around packing heat. You know, my dad and my brother were both people who understood the danger of guns. I grew up around guns. I never owned one. But so I'm not coming at this as a pro or anti gun person. I'm coming at this as a pro adult, pro education person, and not trying to overly empower 15-year-olds to become the center of political debates.
Yeah, but I want to get away from Parkland and ask you a general question that actually moves us back into the realm of expertise. It is impossible for anybody to really know what the people who wrote the Second Amendment would definitively say. Would they say, look, our intention was, you know, a well-armed militia, and we still think citizens have to find a way to not let themselves be overrun, even in an all-powerful state that has nuclear weapons, and yes, you should arm yourself with whatever you want? Or would they say, look, ain't nobody got bayonets anymore, and things have changed? I don't know. I want to ask you, as someone who values expertise, when you think about guns and gun control, because I've seen you tangle with people on Twitter, and I think some fellow conservatives might think that they're going to have a peer with you who's on their side, and then you push
and
back a little.
They're sorely disappointed.
They're sorely disappointed with you. but how can we evaluate what we think that amendment might be intended for in the modern era, because it's so different, and who would have the expertise to really say? Who do you trust?
Well, on this, I think it's important for people who have originalist interpretations of the Constitution, as well as, you know, the folks who make the argument for the living Constitution, to duke it out in public, to present their arguments in an informed, historically literate way, because You cannot pull Thomas Jefferson from the grave to say, "What'd you mean?" You know, or George Mason, "What'd you mean?" And that's up to us. And that's why we've always had a system of courts and appellate courts and constitutional appeal that is meant to take this into the public arena to be debated calmly and without excessive emotion, because I think that's another thing that when it comes to things like gun control or abortion or anything else, people become, you know, wildly emotional, which our system of government is meant to tamp down, not to encourage, and then to put it to a vote. And I think we have a remarkable system that way, because even the Supreme Court is not all powerful. We elect presidents who then have to put those justices on the Supreme Court, who then have to go through a Senate confirmation. So we can do this as adults. The problem is, I think people have become so intellectually lazy and so convinced, and this goes back to kind of freedom of speech issues, they've become convinced that feelings trump everything. Right? It doesn't matter what the Constitution said or what Thomas Jefferson wrote or what George Mason meant. I feel strongly about it. Therefore, my feelings are as good as your facts or your reasoned interpretation. And I think that just leads us down a bad path, because then it's just a matter of seeing whose intense, sweaty emotion can overrule everybody else's view.
What informs your view to be more in favor of gun control?
I like to think I operate in the big squishy middle, because I'm in favor of strict gun control, but I also think it is every American's right to own a weapon. I think the language of the Second Amendment is clear, but that doesn't mean you have the right to own a bazooka. So that's where the middle ground of policy comes in, to say, look, we have this broad, let's leave aside gun control for a moment. We all have freedom of speech. We do not have unlimited freedom of speech, right? I mean, I don't want to drag out old cliches about fire in a movie theater and all that stuff, but I mean, the Supreme Court for 200 years has wrestled with how much speech, you know, is, when are you over the line? When are you provoking violence? And I think that, you know, we're perfectly capable of doing that. So my personal feeling on the gun issue is derived from having read people on both sides of it, considered their arguments, considered the experience of my own family, again, as, you know, police officers, which prejudices me in a particular direction.
But carries some expertise.
But carries...
Sure.
Some, but, you know, again, anecdotes are not data, but they do have a background in it, absolutely. And, you know, knowing the law enforcement community where I grew up. So, yeah, sure, all of those things. And I think the most important thing is we bring some sense of reason to this, that we bring some sense of orderly thinking to what is a very emotional problem. And I think to go back to the issue of children, you know, orderly and less emotional thinking is something you learn. That's why you go to school. I think to see a national anchor, as I did during this whole business shortly after the massacre, you know, a respected news anchor turning literally to a 15-year-old child and saying, "So tell me, what do you think? What do you think we ought to do here? What should our new legislation be?" And I'm thinking to myself, this is really unfair to everybody, including the viewer, and certainly to the young person sitting there, because that's an unanswerable question.
My guest is Tom Nichols, author of The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters, the book now out for just about a year, but it's one of those books that will be timeless, and you can get it now. In fact, Tom takes great delight when he finds out that people get it either as a sincere gift or a trolling gift, which has happened many times. And by the time you hear this interview, he will be long gone on planes around the country going elsewhere, but he's a guest of SUNY Brockport and the American Democracy Project, helping with this visit here to the Rochester area. And a lot of ground to cover, but I want to turn the focus a little bit on the media for a second, because I want to talk about your views on the internet, which has been a disaster when we thought maybe 20 years ago, well, this is great. People will be able to learn a lot more and more quickly, and they will trust more experts more easily and be more informed. Instead, it's kind of gone the other way. But I'm going to blame the media first, because I'll give you a couple of examples. First of all, the media loves to ask people the question that you just posed to the 15-year-old, what do you think? Well, the media does that with the average Joe all the time. They'll say, so what do you think is causing climate change? what do you think should be done about that?
Right.
And there's nothing in the history of the world that turns people who know almost nothing into experts as the NFL draft, where everybody who knows nothing about this, well, our team just screwed it up. You know, they don't know. But what does ESPN ask? Well, what do you think? Who would you have taken?
Who cares? On the Sunday programs when they say, and now we're going to turn to your questions from Facebook and Twitter. And I always find myself every Sunday going, no, don't do it. I don't want it. I want to know what smart people are going to ask them, not what people on Facebook are going to ask.
Well, sometimes, you know, we feel like there's interaction with the audience that if it's thoughtful and it's really strong, it can bring great value. And that's one thing that I'm defending our listeners, but I'm defending our listeners because I think they're really well informed. But I take the point. And what I'm saying is, when the media turns and asks directly, it's one thing to say, let's open the phones. It's another to say, hey, what do you think American policy vis-a-vis Syria and ISIS should be?
Right.
Or, you know, sectarianism that most people have never studied.
Right.
And yet we're asking, you know, anybody to opine this. Well, why do we do that?
Let me put in my bit of love here for NPR as well, as a long, you know, avid NPR listener. And I think informed participation with the public is great. I mean, I'm really in favor. This is one reason I travel, you know, the country doing this stuff, is I think it's important to talk with people. I think experts have to get out and deal with the public. And I'm a big fan of things like carefully moderated town hall meetings, for example. Come and ask the Secretary of State, you know, what we should be doing and what's going on. The problem I have is when, as you just pointed out, when they say, now let's go to Facebook and find out what Joe 762Patriot thinks we ought to be doing about chemical weapons in Syria. Well, you know, there's only so much time in a day. If you've got the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Defense or someone who knows this subject sitting there, I really don't want to hear from people, as you say, that really don't have background on it. I mean, that time on the air is a pretty scarce resource. And I think we've gotten used to this. And I think it indulges the word we haven't used yet, and I think is important to the book, is narcissism. It indulges this narcissism that says, no matter what's happening in this discussion, it's just not complete until you tell us what you want and what you think. And on the one hand, you want to encourage civic engagement. On the other hand, you want to encourage responsible civic engagement. When people have asked me, well, how should I interact with an expert? I always say, start with a question. We love answering your questions. Experts will do anything to answer your questions. But if you start by saying, let me tell you what we ought to do. That's usually when the expert says, oh, this is going to be a long day.
I read half an article on single payer, so I would like to tell you,
yes,
health policy expert, what we need to do.
Tom, I don't think you understand Russia. Let me explain this to you. One of the examples I tend to use is a couple of years ago, the Washington Post asked people, what do you think we ought to do about Ukraine? Should we put troops? And people were really hard over saying, we ought to put U.S. troops into Ukraine. And then we'd say, the Post asked them, do you know where that is? No idea. And then they'd show them a map and say, it's right next to Russia. And then people would say, oh, okay, maybe not that. Well, that didn't stop you from having a real strong opinion before you knew where it was. And that's the thing that really worries me, because that's how public policy debates get instantly derailed, is I have very strong views on this, even though I don't know a thing about it.
I think there's two separate things that I want to address with Tom now. And so we're going to stay there and we're going to talk about what he thinks can be done to maybe start mitigating that. And then I want to shift to something that's even more, that's different and I think more pernicious, which is the anti-expertise industry, which is thriving now.
Yes.
It's not just people who don't realize they're uninformed or they're struggling with the Dunning-Kruger effect or whatever the case may be. It is the lampooning of experts that I think is really dangerous. And we're going to get there in a moment. But let's take the person who didn't know where Ukraine was but still had an opinion, mm-hmm, on whether we should send troops there. How are you going to change a person's way of thinking to where they're going to say, you know, that's an interesting question, but I don't know that I'm prepared to answer it?
Well, that's a great question, because the expert community, I think, is divided on this, and I am in the minority. I think most experts would tell you to use the kind of traditional Socratic method, right? To say, okay, that's an interesting point you've just made. Let's unpack that. Let's explore it. Let's think about it. I've been finding that tends to play into people who just want to talk about the thing they want to talk about anyway and won't listen to you. And so I've become much more straightforward in saying, let's start by establishing something very important. You're wrong. And, you know, people push back on that, but I also think it saves a lot of time. I mean, you know, that we're in a period now where people are seriously once again talking about flat earth theories and doubting the moon landing. So if someone says, you know, I'm not sure that we really landed on the moon, I personally will never start by saying, oh, you don't think we landed on the moon? Well, that's interesting. Let's unpack that. Let's talk about it. No, I'm going to start with, trust me, I'm an expert. We landed on the moon, okay? You just have to accept that. Now let's talk about, you know, how it happened and let me explain it to you and let's go from there. Because I think one of the things that's become increasingly difficult in my experience of over 30 years of teaching is breaking through the wall of ego that people have about ever hearing that they're wrong. I think students used to be a bit more humble. They were a bit more willing to listen. I think the average citizen would start with an acknowledgement of, look, I'm not an expert on European politics, so I don't know where Ukraine is, but, you know, and they would go from there. We've really developed a culture where people feel they have to have definitive, fully formed opinions on everything at the drop of a hat. And I think, as you know, you talked about the media. I think that is in part a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week media cycle. As I say in the book, you know, CNN calls its afternoon broadcast the Situation Room. Like, you're, you know, if you're watching us, you're going to help the president decide whether or not to launch nuclear weapons. You know, every day, Wolf Blitzer says, you're in the Situation Room. And I always yell back, no, I'm in my living room. You know, it's the news. It's okay. It doesn't have to be breaking now. You know, it's just the news. But I think it encourages that sense of importance in the viewer to say, I have very important things to decide this afternoon. Before dinner arrives, I'm going to have to figure out what to do about Korea. And I think we have to stop doing that. And I think experts have to stop enabling that.
News is addicted to drama and slogans. You know, live local late breaking is a popular one for local news. Or one local station used to have digging for answers, reporting them first, which was way better than their old slogan, which was skimming the surface for answers, reporting them like whenever.
Well, you know? my favorite is happening now. Well, by definition, everything is happening now. So, you know, I mean, who's going to run a Chiron that says, you know, Dateline last Thursday.
But I've got a 6-year-old son, and I want to believe that by middle school, he will be taught in school, in class, not just from his parents, what motivated reasoning is, what confirmation bias is, what epistemology is.
Good luck with that.
But shouldn't it be?
Yes, of course it should. And it's very difficult, especially, and this is where I think, you know, I will go back, even though I usually disappoint conservatives, I will come back to their side on one important issue here, which is the problem of teaching to the test, which is that increasingly K-12 education is object-oriented, fact-oriented testing rather than the development of critical thinking skills. So now, with that said, I think a lot of teachers out there are really doing some great work, and they've started to include things like digital literacy, critical thinking, returning to debate kind of exercises that are not what debates became, which is, you know, fast talking, fact slinging, but actual, you know, first affirmative, second affirmative, first negative kind of structured debates. So it's happening. And I don't blame the teachers for this. I mean, I blame the schools and the school boards. It's happening against a headwind of all that's fine as long as the students perform well on standardized exams, which I don't think tell you very much, to be honest.
More with Tom Nichols, author of The Death of Expertise, coming up on Connections.
I'm Megan Mack. Tuesday on The Next Connections, the Rochester City School District has released its proposed budget, and it has slated an increase in funding for bilingual staff and services. This comes after more than 500 students from Puerto Rico enrolled in the district since moving to Rochester after Hurricane Maria devastated the island. We'll talk to experts about the kinds of services bilingual students need. Talk to you Tuesday.
Well, what we just learned from Tom Nichols, my guest for the hour, who is the author of The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters, is that when you follow him on Twitter, Tom has no hesitation to sort of smack someone down or have a little fun with it. But what we're seeing is there's a real noble goal. He's just decided that epistemologically, that's the best way to do it. Cut through the noise and just say you're wrong and sometimes lampoon somebody.
Yeah, I mean, people think that I do it just to be mean, and all right, sometimes I do. You know, point taken. I mean, I'm a human being. I have my bad days like everybody else. But most of the time, when I'm just cutting through the fog and saying, look, you're just wrong. I'm not going to have this discussion with you. It's not just in order to save time and to kind of cut to the meat of the question. It's also not to keep enabling a kind of seriousness about misinformation. You know, when someone says, I think the world's flat, and you say, well, why do you think there? How do we... You know, what you're really doing is you're legitimizing that point of view. You're saying your point of view isn't, it might be right, let me take it seriously. And I think that plays to this notion that you cannot hurt anyone's feelings by telling them they're wrong. On the other hand, I went through years of schooling in the 1960s and 70s where, you know, the capital of India was not what I thought it was. It's what it is. Or, you know, the longest river in the world is a definable measurement, not what I happen to want it to be at that moment. And I think we need to get back to that, because I think otherwise we're just treading water.
Well, the anti-expertise industry is thriving, and the Travel Channel, as I think you just linked to a story, they're producing a new show called Mysteries and Myths with Megan Fox. Yes, the actor Megan Fox, who is neither an archaeologist nor a historian, and the show is going to try to poke holes in archaeological history, and this is upset, guess what, actual archaeologists.
Right.
Here's a quote from Megan Fox talking about the show in Deadline. Quote, "History only gives us a one-sided view of the truth. I haven't spent my entire life building a career in academia, so I don't have to worry about my reputation or being rebuked by my colleagues, which allows me to push back on the status quo. So much of our history needs to be re-examined." End quote. This
is radio, so people can't see my head exploding.
Yeah, this is the end, right? This is the end of civilization?
Well, you know, no, it's the natural end point of a culture of celebrity. But there is a teachable moment in this Megan Fox dumpster fire, which is that, you know, her answer about, the history is one-sided and I am going to present the things that professional historians don't want to tell you, is actually a death of expertise problem that I've run into for most of my career. That the way people deal with complexity and uncertainty and, you know, the fact that the world is big and scary and complicated is they say, well, you experts, you know, don't tell us everything. So we're going to find the hidden knowledge. And that's very empowering. That's why conspiracy theories flourish and are coming back in America, because they're empowering. It's empowering to say, I have secret knowledge. I know things that make me important and help me to make orderly sense of the world. And it usually happens after a trauma, right? After 9/11, people said, it can't just be that 17 or 19 guys with box cutters took down four aircraft. It just can't be possible. So it had to be that Dick Cheney, you know, in league with the reverse vampires who, you know, and the Illuminati, because that's almost in some ways, it's a more comforting explanation, because then it's not just randomness. And so this whole Megan Fox thing is part of a cottage industry of, I'll tell you things that people won't tell you. I just can't. Just to give you an even, since we're on the, you know, things that make my head explode, I'm writing a new introduction to the book, because it's going into, again, surprising me, it's going to paperback and multiple languages. And one of my readers passed along, apparently tens of thousands of people have been irrigating their lower anatomy with cabbage juice and salt and things because they think it will cure cancer. And that started because somebody went on the internet, of course, and said, here's what the doctors won't tell you. And this is where it gets dangerous. This is where I'm linking back to Megan Fox. It's one thing for Megan Fox to say, you know, the historians won't tell you that, you know, it was aliens, right? You know, who built the pyramids? Elvis. But it's more dangerous to have somebody say the doctors won't tell you that irrigating your colon with, you know, cabbage juice. And apparently this thing has, as God is my witness, the words that are in the story about it, it's a poop cult, where people believe that, like, just incredible amounts of diarrhea cure diseases because it irrigates out your system. This is crazy, but it's based in the notion that doctors won't tell you this because cabbage is cheap and doctors are expensive. And people have died, literally, from, you know, people with end-stage cancer have said, well, you know, instead of palliative care, prolonging my life or whatever it is, I'm going to drink, you know, gallons and gallons of cabbage juice. So we can laugh about the Megan Fox thing, but when you start translating that into medicine or public safety or public policy or gun control or whatever, suddenly, you know, people get hurt and it's not that funny anymore.
And the book also tackles, I think, an important distinction, which is that some of your critics say, oh, so you only want ivory tower experts to speak to ivory tower experts and the proletariat never gets to have a part of the conversation. And you are explicitly not saying that either.
No. In fact, I spend quite a lot of time in the book separating the notion of elites and experts and policymakers.
So do a little definition
there. Yeah. I mean, an expert is somebody who knows a lot about a field and it has definitive knowledge about it. Elites are people who occupy the top rungs of various professions in their life. I mean, Megan Fox.
Megan Fox.
She's rich. She's beautiful. She's an actress. She's got a limo. I mean, if Megan Fox isn't one of the elite, nobody is. And policymakers are totally third class of people, not third class, but another class of people who sit down and say, okay, you guys want clean water in Rochester. All right, let's figure out how you pay for that and who zones it and where the pipes go and, you know, how much it costs and all of those things. I mean, these groups of people are not always the same. And I found over the past year or so, when a lot of people have criticized the book saying, well, you just want elites to run things. No, I don't think that's, I mean, look, Donald Trump is an elite. I mean, if Donald Trump doesn't count as elite, nobody counts as elite. But I don't think Donald Trump is particularly an expert in anything relating to governing. So I actually think it's the other way around. I think experts need to include the public, but the public is going to have to learn to ask questions instead of delivering lectures and hear the answers. And I think experts, this is where I am critical of experts, I think experts lack a certain amount of empathy in dealing with the public. Because we live in a world that's obvious to us, right? I mean, you talk to me or my host here in Brockport as a fellow Russia expert, you know, we can talk to each other like twins language. You know, we start saying things that people would find incomprehensible because there was never a time that for us, Russian politics was a mystery. We forget that sometimes. And that with the public, we have to say, you know, we're going to start and kind of get you up to speed about where we are. And I think we have to be better about that. I think the public and the expert class and the policymakers have to be more coordinated and have to speak to each other more clearly so that elites who are in control can make better policy.
Well, you mentioned Russia, and I've got a Russian expert in studio, so I can ask for your expert opinion here. Are you someone who thinks that the word collusion is overdone? Is it still a possible finding from Mueller? And do you think that his investigation is worthwhile? I have plenty of ideas having read your feed for a long time, but I think our listeners would want to know how you feel about it.
I'm so close to an Alec Baldwin, you know, no collusion moment. But the problem is that I think coming out as a Russia guy, I don't think of collusion the same way that the public does. I don't believe that Donald Trump sat down with the Russian ambassador and said, look, you know, you take care of my interests over there and I'll lift sanctions. I don't think that happened. And I don't think you're going to find, I mean, I shouldn't say never because this is the world of political twilight zone that we live in now. But my guess is that people on the campaign had contacts that were inappropriate with people in Russia. And that, you know, everybody involved is too smart to ever put a quid pro quo on the table. But I think a lot of this stuff is done with a kind of a nod and a wink and an understanding. And so I think in that sense, was there collusion between the campaign and the Russians? Yes. But that's a hypothesis on my part. Is it a crime? I'm not a lawyer. Recognizing my expertise, I'm not an FBI agent or a lawyer. So let me put it this way, and I'll throw this as a challenge to the Republicans who have said no collusion. If there were this level of interaction between Hillary Clinton and the Russians or Barack Obama and the Iranians, the Republicans would have impeached him by now. Let's put it that way. So if you're thinking about collusion as a kind of something that is against the interests of the United States and a political transgression, whether it's legal or not, I think that the campaign, and I'm just not, I don't think the president himself, again, because I just don't think that's how it works in the real world. But I think there were lower level people on the campaign who talked to people that they had to know. I mean, if you talk to people coming to you from, you know, that have connections in the Kremlin, you know you're talking to the Russian government. You know you're talking to the Russian security services. Nobody can be that dumb. I probably shouldn't say that either because, you know, there's the
careful there.
Yeah, the level of dumb is kind of striking. But so, you know, do I think there's that kind of collusion in the sense of an inappropriate contact between a campaign and a foreign power? Sure. Do I think that there was, you know, direct quid pro quo between the candidate and a foreign government? I really doubt that. I just don't see it.
Your concern is that when people stop believing that they need to seek out any expertise, that they're the expert on everything, it's not just annoying. As you said, in the medical community, it's dangerous. It's also dangerous for a democracy. Is that what you see happening right now?
That's really what undergirds most of the book is that, you know, a lot of people have said to me, oh, you just wrote this book because you're irritated. And, you know, and, you know, they're right.
yeah.
You know, you vain professors want people to listen to you. Well, of course, you know, we profess. That's right in the title of our job. But my bigger concern is that this really does just wear away the foundations of representative democracy, because you have to trust. I've worked for a mayor, a state representative, and a U.S. senator. People who work in politics have to make decisions across a wide array of issues every day, and they have to lean on experts to do that. And if the public says that experts don't know anything, then the only alternative is to have, you know, 300 million people every 2 weeks vote on the budget like it's, you know, Athens times a billion. And that's just not how our system of government functions. It wouldn't work. Most people don't bother to inform themselves enough to engage in that kind of plebiscitary democracy. The founding fathers specifically resisted it because they didn't want that kind of behavior in our system of government. You know, one of the things I talk about in the book, unrelated to the United States, is Brexit, where, you know, the fate of a nation in a multi-nation union was decided by a night of heavy drinking. You know, where 51% kind of woke up the next morning and said, what? We won? Really?
Like, what do we do now?
Yeah, what do we do now? The U.S. system, it was specifically designed never to allow moments like that to happen. And so if you're going to have a functioning republic where legislators, I mean, you know, I can tell you, a U.S. senator does childcare in the morning, arms control in the afternoon, and foreign trade at night. I mean, they do everything all day long, and they have a huge staff of experts who try to get them up to speed on this. If the public says, look, just do what we tell you, even though we don't know what we're doing, then you get outcomes, and this is something I point out very often, you get outcomes like we got in 2016, where people said to many of their elected representatives, we want you to go to Washington and repeal Obamacare as long as you keep the Affordable Care Act. Now, think about that. I mean, there is a significant number of people who do not know the difference, don't realize they're the same thing, and told their representatives to do both of those things at the same time. And when their elected representatives kind of say, no, all right, we'll just figure this out when we get to D.C., the public says, you're not listening to us. Well, because we can't make sense of what you're telling us. And I think that becomes very dangerous to the future of democracy.
And what to do about it? Yeah, I know you saw on Twitter, a listener named Jack wanted to know about your thoughts when you said, look, do not lift a finger, as painful as it might be, to ameliorate Trump policy failures. They wanted this. Let the voters have it. Jack is saying, that's easy for you. You're going to be comfortable. You have a comfortable life. There are people who are really going to be hurt by bad policy, and we shouldn't just not lift a finger and challenge it. So why are you saying, let them put their hand on the stove?
It's a cold-hearted thing to say.
You concede that point.
I absolutely concede that point. But I think the danger is, you know, it's the difference between going cold turkey or, you know, trying to wean yourself off of a drug. And, you know, at some point, do you really have to learn that trade wars are bad? If the president wants tariffs, and that's what his voters wanted from him, and that they're going to doubt their legitimacy of their system of government unless they get those tariffs, then my answer is stop trying to mitigate the effect of those tariffs. This is what the public wanted. If they really feel the need to touch that hot stove, then the short-term damage, I think, is compensated by the long-term learning. You know, think about how long, for example, the United States has gone without protectionism because we learned that lesson. Think about, you know, things like populism, where, you know, we touched that hot stove a few times and then had a long period where we've left it aside. You know, the protectionism and populism and nationalism caused this thing called World War II that was a bad idea. And I think, you know, if people really think that tariffs are going to solve their problems, then my answer is, you know, maybe we should all share the pain for a year while we learn, if we have to, that tariffs are a bad idea. Now, I totally take your you know, Jack's point on Twitter that, you know, this hurts innocent people. I think the other thing that hurts innocent people, though, is doing this a half a step at a time. You know, let's keep doing this, you know, one cigarette a day until we're smoking two packs. You know, it's kind of like the thing about when you're a kid and you get caught smoking. Look, smoke the pack, and then you'll know why you shouldn't smoke. I don't have a better answer for it. I wish I did, because you can't reason with people about this because they haven't seen it. This is kind of, let me just drag in vaccines for a moment and say, this is kind of like when people say, what do we need vaccines for? Nobody gets those diseases. Well, you know, I told a student that I was vaccinated against smallpox, and he said, why would they vaccinate you against smallpox? Nobody gets that. Well, yeah, there's a reason. You know, trade wars. Why haven't we had trade wars? Because they're bad. And if it takes one to make us remember why they're bad, then maybe that's, you know, because I think the danger here is if people don't get that, they're going to say that the elites thwarted them and they didn't get the tariffs they want and they didn't get Obamacare rolled back and they didn't get, you know, poisoned rivers again and all that stuff. So I admit it's a pretty cold-hearted approach, but I'm not sure what else to do.
I want to conclude with our last few minutes about a pretty separate subject, but I think it's important because, fair to say, you're a never Trump Republican, never Trump conservative. Never
well,
Republican.
I was I'm for now, never Trump Republican. Although I'm not sure that there's much left of the party, but I was a Republican back in the 70s and the 80s. My first vote was for Ronald Reagan in 1980.
Okay, so you wrote a long thread on what it means to be a conservative and why conservatism doesn't mean Republicanism, but what it means to you and why it still matters to you. And I thought it's worth visiting that because I think sometimes we conflate political party.
Yes. Especially because today's Republican Party has, I think, in some ways become a big state protectionist, you know, redistributive state that if you'd have described it in 1970, people would say was a very liberal party. So
do you mind if I just read a couple tweets?
Sure,
and you can
go ahead.
Explain more. So this is some of what you wrote. I was asked what it means to be a conservative, and this is from Twitter. You said, I think the basic issue is the view of freedom, human nature, and history. Conservatives start from a position, sometimes too much so, of individual freedom without the presence of the state. Every incursion of state power must be justified. Taxes and laws are tools, not holy writ. We don't see the state as a good thing in itself, some benign entity that is meant to create a better life or institute justice. We think that comes from within each person, and the state is merely an agent that keeps order against the inevitable failures of human virtue. Likewise, we don't think human nature is a blank slate upon which the state can write its own code and thus somehow create a new man. Human nature, for most conservatives, I think, is relatively fixed and prone to sin and failure, as well as great virtue, and thus the state has no right to engage in great projects of reforming human nature. The state is our servant, not our teacher or headmaster. It has no experience beyond our will to support it and our recognition and continuing approval that it is acting justly. End quote. Now, there's more that you write there, but I wonder how your progressive, your liberal friends feel about laying out conservatism in that way as opposed to the caricatures we get in the media.
I had some very productive conversations with progressive friends about that because they definitely keyed on the role of the state. And because I think progressives who, to their credit, I mean, this is one place where I have a real, you know, soft spot for progressives who have understood that capitalism and the free market and, you know, kind of unregulated democracy can really plow under the most vulnerable people, minorities, people who have lesser skills. And so for them, they see the state as the defender of the downtrodden against the most capable and able people in this society. The state is kind of like the high school principal that doesn't let everybody pick on the weak kids in gym class, you know? And I think progressives, you know, kind of, I think there were more than a few progressives who said, yeah, I get that about what you're saying. But I think the underlying difference that we still have is that progressives, and this is where I part company with them quite severely, progressives really do have this notion of the perfectibility of human beings, that if the state just teaches you well enough, that if you institute the right kinds of laws, the state can kind of be your mom and explain how you should live. And I think conservatives recoil from that because, especially as a Russia guy, that's what the Soviet Union thought, that the state could be your teacher. That, you know, the army, the phrase, the Soviet army was called the school of the nation, right? That it taught you how to be a Soviet citizen and that you could create a new man, a new woman who was free of all of the normal human failings. I think conservatives on this are much more savvy about the failures of human nature that are inevitable, that, you know, that we are you know, that we are venal, that we are petty. And I think the progressives believe that can be sponged away with enough government intrusion. I always like to say, though, that I think conservatives and progressives of good faith really want to get to the same place. They just don't agree how to get there. I mean, I don't know any decent conservative who wants, you know, children to be living in the streets, or people with, you know, mental illness to go untreated, or people not to have medical care or roof over their head. They disagree about how to create a society that sustains those goods in a way that is not necessarily impinging on the rights of others. Of course, there's a classic cliche about progressives will give public aid to 1,000 people in hopes of helping the one who needs it, who need it. Conservatives will withhold it from 1,000 people because there's one person ripping it off. And I think that's probably
is there some fairness in that?
Yeah, I think that's a fair argument. And I think where, again, where the good, sensible middle road of policy goes is to say, how much do we want to help people? How much, you know, do we? How much fraud can we tolerate? Because all of those are normal. Again, conservatives start and say that's all normal human behavior. And so in the book, I point out, you know, expertise gets dragged into this because people say, well, does unemployment payments, do they make you lazy? Well, it depends. Do you think capitalism is cruel, or do you think markets function? And I encourage people, before just labeling themselves conservative or progressive, to say, what do I mean by that? You know, what am I actually trying to say here? What do I think the nature of a human being is? And I think if we started from that, and if we started with a little more goodwill toward each other, rather than identifying each other as enemy camps, we'd probably get a lot more done in politics and in our society at large.
The reason I said earlier this hour, as we wrap up with Tom Nichols, that I think his book is one of the most important written in our lifetimes, is as a host of 500 hours plus per year of a talk show, it's amazing how many callers will call when we've got experts on the panel, and they'll say, well, I'm calling to tell you why you're wrong. Not, I have a question first,
right,
or let me consider this. It happens all the time. And this book is at least this real clear call for us to start thinking about that in ourselves. I'm thinking about our children and their generation, to trust experts, not necessarily elites, but expertise.
And not to trust them without reservation.
No.
I mean, to question them rather than to, you know, as you say, when people call up to say, look, I have some concerns and I'd like to ask you some questions, instead of starting by saying, I know you're an expert, but here's why you're wrong.
Here's why you're wrong. Yeah, not all opinions are equally valid. It's okay to say it.
It's okay to say it.
Tom Nichols, who is the author of The Death of Expertise, has been teaching us that. Thanks for taking the time to be here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we will talk with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.